The views and opinions expressed by the guests of the Inspira podcast do not necessarily represent the official policy or position of any agency of the United States government or any organization, public or private.
One, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to the Inspira podcast, hosted by your girl, me, Erica Mueller Chen. I'm an international development specialist with over a decade of experience leveraging the amazing power of sport to promote peace and positive social impact. My career has allowed me to live in Europe, Southern Africa, and Latin America. In 2022, I accepted an offer for my dream job in sports diplomacy. And I also became an employee family member to a U.S. diplomat, aka an EFM. This podcast is all about inspiration and career advice. Each episode, I'll interview an inspirational global changemaker working in sport for development, social impact, or the diplomatic service. This series is perfect if you have interest in breaking into one of these sectors. Or you've already landed that dream role and are keen to learn from thought leaders. Enjoy today's episode and stay inspired.
Many of the events are just not sport for development vehicles. They aren't. And if they are not strategically integrated in some of the wider sport for development work, that they may be good for raising awareness, but that's where it ends. But if we claim that events can have such a big impact, well then, we probably have to do a better job in integrating them with existing programs and having more of a sustainable idea or strategic planning from the start.
Welcome, friends. Today we are here with Dr. Nico Schullenkorf. He is Professor of Sport Management at the University of Technology, Sydney in Australia. Nico is passionate about using sport as a vehicle for community development, and his research focuses on the social, cultural, and health-related outcomes of sport and event projects. Dr. Nico, for more than two decades, has been leading sport for development and health promotion programs in countries such as Sri Lanka, Israel, and the Pacific Islands. He is the co-founder and past editor of the Journal of Sport for Development, which is where him and I had the chance to collaborate a little bit more closely. I'm so excited to chat with you. So thank you so much, Nico. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Erica. Good to see you today again.
Dr. Nico, one thing that I like to do before we get to the questions is mention why the guest inspires me, because I've chosen to call this podcast Inspira. I really am inspired and appreciate your commitment to supporting students, whether that's through your teaching, your mentorship, or producing research with the hopes of increasing resources for people in the sport for development sector, especially young people. And so I actually did some digging in my email archives to see like when Nico and I connected and what the story was. And Nico, I think it was back in 2014, and I reached out to you on LinkedIn, and I ended up sending you this really long email saying like, oh, like, I really want to work in sport for development. I've got a little bit of experience, but what do you think I should do? And I still remember it. You were so gracious. And, you know, we connected on Skype, which was all the rage before 2020. Yeah. And you just really, I think, give to people in this sector, including myself. And I really appreciate that. And I'm excited to learn more about your journey and the things that are important to you.
Well, thanks very much, Erica, for the kind words, and I'm glad that some of the engagement that we had have stayed in your mind as such a positive experience. Certainly, it's something, I guess, if you work at a university and you're doing research, you're doing teaching, but I guess one of the best things is that you connect with people who are passionate about something that you're also passionate about. And whilst I'm teaching in a sport management program, there is the sport for development space that I've, spent most of my time in. And when you've got students that pick up that particular area as their favorite area of interest, then you always have that desire to tell them a little bit more and perhaps excite them for a career in that space. And when I got your email back then, you can feel it sort of in those lines that someone really wanted to know rather than just tick a box and reach out. So now I'm glad that it has worked out and that you've progressed so well with the journal, but also with the other experiences in sport for development, but also international management, including what you're doing now. Great to be here today.
Thank you. Thank you for reflecting a little bit with me. And I will ask you to keep reflecting, but more about yourself and less about me as we move forward. And perhaps, Nico, I can ask you to give us a brief overview of your sports career journey and what led you to Sydney.
Yes, that's a good one. And it brings me back to study times as an undergrad student. And perhaps that's why, you know, I was always so happy to answer questions from young students who wanted to get into this space. So I was born in Germany. I grew up in Germany, did my high school there. And at the end of our high school, all the German boys back then were conscripted. We had to go to the army or, as an alternative, could choose to do community service. Okay, so this was after high school. You're 19 years old in Germany when you finish. You have to do a year or a bit more than a year where you do contribute to the community or to your country. And for me, the army was never really an option. So I decided I wanted to do community service work. And I was fortunate that there are some opportunities to do that service overseas. And so around the world, there is communities for German-speaking people in other countries that provide services for, you know, the Germans abroad. And I landed the opportunity to work in Sydney for the German-speaking community in Sydney, where I was helping and assisting, I guess, for a year, mainly with older people, but also with some of the youth groups on an international level. So this was the first time I went overseas, ticked the box for avoiding the army and getting into community work.
Were your parents happy with that?
Back then, this was 1999, so I wrote about 50 letters back then, because there was no email, well, not properly established. So it was 50 letters to all the German communities abroad, and got two letters back, one from your neighboring country in Chile,
okay,
and one from Australia. And they were both suggesting it could work, we could do the service there. But in 2000, Sydney had the Olympic Games. So it was very clear to me that I wanted to go to Australia and go there in 1999, finish in 2000, and the Olympics were sort of the highlight at the end of my trip over here. My parents were happy about that. They you know, saw it as a great opportunity. I was, you know, living in a tiny place, 4,000 people in Germany, and there was just this excitement that I could go and see the world. But I guess they were expecting me to come back a year later and stay home. Uh-huh. And that's, of course, never happened. So, yeah, so there it changed a little bit. But I went on I did go back to Germany, did my undergrad studies in international business and management, but always had the desire to go back to Australia at the end of that. And, well, in Germany, you don't have student fees, right? So studying is for free. And so undergrad studies for 3 years saved me a lot of money, but I saved up money to spend on my master's studies, which I did back here in Sydney then. So I went back to Australia, studied over here, and yeah, then stayed on to do my PhD, and then, yeah, spent my first couple of months, I suppose, in Sri Lanka back then, which is the country or the topic that I focused on during my PhD studies. But yes, that's how it started. But that was my second stint to Sri Lanka already. And this is where it brings me back to your question about the first experiences abroad or the first experiences internationally. As an undergrad student of international business, all the students had to do an assignment abroad. So a practicum or a practical work experience abroad. And that was my first chance to spend time in Sri Lanka, a country that was back then had just ended basically a 20-year civil war, and they were on the path towards a peace agreement between the Sinhalese dominated government and the Tamil Tigers. And so they had 20 years of civil war. The Tamils wanted to establish an independent Tamil state on the island of Sri Lanka. The government, of course, didn't like that idea, so there was 20 years of civil strife. They had come to an agreement, ceasefire agreement was in place in 2002 and 2003, And whilst it was a full peace, not a full peace agreement, it was at least ceasefire and you could start community projects again. And so I did my internship at a German-based NGO in Sri Lanka that used sport and sport events to bring together the different cultural and ethnic groups of the country in a peaceful sporting environment. And that's how my journey into sport for development started. It wasn't intentional initially, but it always, I guess, once you're hooked, it's morphed into a career for me since then. And yeah, so that's how it started as with an internship. That's how I came back to the country then for my PhD, and we went from there. So that's in a nutshell how I ended up in Sydney with a couple of other spots and placements abroad in between.
And you mentioned where Sport for Development entered the picture. Do you remember if it was called Sport for Development when you were in Sri Lanka, or if it was more like retrospective? Once you've got your
Yeah.
PhD, you're like, that's what it was.
Correct. And that's exactly how it was. So 2003, when I spent time in Sri Lanka for the first time, I had to do my, well, I was writing my bachelor dissertation, like an honors thesis, similar to an honors thesis. And we tried to look for research around sport and reconciliation and peace building. But there wasn't the field of sport for development wasn't established. So that, you know, it probably was established formally, I'd say probably in 2003 with the Maglingen Declaration. So 2003 itself, there was no research on that space. There, of course, have been people interested in sport for development, what we now call sport for development, and they've looked at it from different perspectives, and we'll probably get to some of that inspirational work later on. But it wasn't labeled that. So you didn't have you know, sort of a place to go to where you could find a collection of sport for development work. So you had to sort of pick and choose from people that were interested in sport and look at some management literature, sociology literature, anthropology, cultural studies, but there wasn't anything that brought it together. And that's where the whole sport for development movement from 2003 onwards tried to contribute to putting this all into a basket and making it easier for people to, I guess, to find relevant literature or relevant information about that space. But it was not called sport for development. And so the first publications as well, they were all having different labels and no one had coined that term yet. So yes, it was a bit more eclectic in those days.
Do you remember what motivated you to pursue the research side of things or academia as opposed to what we might call the practitioner side of things? I mean, I know you've experienced both, but I understand your real
Yeah.
focus and contribution has been in academia.
Yes, correct. And definitely the, but it was never my intention. So, yeah, it, but basically the reason is that there was no one in academia who had a role that was labeled sport for development because it didn't exist back then. Okay. So, I wasn't a sociologist. I wasn't strong enough as a sociologist to just run that career or as a management scholar to run that career. It needed to be something that was more applied to sport for me to make any sense. So the first experiences were as a volunteer back in Sri Lanka in 2003 when I was a student. And I really wanted to stay in the sports field and manage those projects. So a bit like the people that you've already interviewed, you know, getting in working for an NGO, or having my own NGO and getting sport as my medium to make a difference. But in the master's then, it was a coursework master's. It wasn't research focused, and that was not the intention originally. And I guess then at the end of my coursework master's, in one subject, we had to I guess present an idea for an event that we could create and that could be staged that would make a difference. And that could be an economic difference, a social difference, health related. It was pretty open, but it was an event management assignment. And I put this idea out with sport events and how they could perhaps be better integrated to make a difference rather than having one-off mega events that perhaps don't always make the difference that we're hoping that they make. So that lecturer then, when he read the assignment, and I must have done an okay job with it, he said, look, this, I really think this has something, and why don't you think about moving this further and perhaps looking into some more research around this? Let's take you to a conference that we've got next month here that we're organizing. Maybe you can share some of your ideas there, and you never know, maybe something comes of it. And that's how it started. And it was never my intention to get into the research space. But once I was in there and I realized I was doing an okay job with some of that research, it was a nice way to connect that academic side with still some really practical involvement. Because if I, in academia, you've got so many people that just do everything from their desk and they spend time in the between the library and their office, basically. And if I didn't have the practical, I guess, engagement on the sports fields, I'd miss something, and that would not be a career that I'd accept. And so having the practical part, even if it's smaller, of course, but still as a as an important element to the work we do at the university, that's excellent. So with that combination, I think it's worked out well for me.
I'd love to know more about some of those specific experiences where you saw sport for development in action.
Yes. Okay. Now, when I came to the end of my PhD, we had to choose examiners, right? So you have to have someone to examine your thesis. And in Australia back then, it was three people that would look at your work and assess it. And they all had to be from outside my institution. So you look for people that are experts in the field. And I was always inspired by work that John Sugden and his group had done around football for peace in Israel, some work in Palestine, but mainly in the northern parts of Israel. And John, obviously, as an academic at the University of Brighton, and we reached out to him and asked if he was willing, what I say we, my supervisors, reached out to him if he was willing to, I guess, examine the thesis. And he agreed, which was excellent, because I had read some of his work that he published on Israel and sport for development in journals, and the way that he had structured it, the way his thinking worked, that's, I guess, one of those inspirational ones where you think, yeah, this makes sense. And I, got yep. Plus he had this active practical involvement, which I found quite inspiring. And so I had met John at a conference that we organized earlier, and heard him present, and I just, now, once I was able to understand him with his very thick accent, I realized that it was fantastic. And I really enjoyed speaking to him. He examined the thesis, he was happy with it, and invited me to come along to Israel and Palestine the year after to do some research with him and the team, as a basically as a volunteer. And I just loved it. Yeah, it was the inspiration from him initially, but also you've got people on the way that inspire you for different reasons. And sometimes, and this is perhaps why I always think it's important for young scholars in particular, or students as well, to give them those couple of minutes where they've got questions. And when they are actually sincere about that question, then you can make a difference here. And I remember that that conference that I was referring to earlier, when I was still a student in my master's program, and I came along to, I guess, present at this conference an idea of using events to achieve social development. When I presented, I got the first three questions, and I presented my idea, my proposal, right? And the first guy was from the UK, and he shot the whole thing down. You would not believe it. He said, "Oh, this is not research. What are you talking about? You haven't thought this through. There's no element of methodology that is developed. Like, this is, basically, it was really a waste of time." You're already super nervous as a student going in, and then you hear this first up, and he was probably right. I hadn't thought about a proper methodology. But I had no idea about all that stuff back then. It was just, out of a master's project. Well, here's my idea. I want to research it this and this way. Very, very surface level, but just what I thought was an interesting idea. And then the second person, said, "Oh, look, this is, you probably have to put a lot of work in it, but really, it's something new for the events. It was an event conference, event space. So, okay. And then this third person put the hand up and said, look, you've got something here that no one in the event space has really thought about properly. And in the sports space, I can give you a bit of an advice where people from different disciplines have started to look at this space. And if you're interested in it, we won't have the time now, but later on at the conference, let's catch up and I'll, you know, connect you to people and we'll work it out. And that, of course, was very nice. And I thought, well, at least this guy's been, you know, positive. But then at the end of the conference, I then found out who it was. And that was Lawrence Chalip. I don't know if, you know, for those of you who don't know, or you, if you don't know, Lawrence, he was probably the big sport event person out there, the biggest scholar you could probably find, the most reputable scholar, certainly up there. And I had no idea. I just didn't know it was him. I didn't know anyone. But when I knew it was him and someone with his experience and knowledge, willing to look at that as something that has potential, I thought, okay, we'll have to follow this up. And so I spent a lot of time with him at that conference, visited him as well when he was in Australia, and we sort of brainstormed ideas. And I'll never forget the time that he gave me, and also just that very first impetus of saying, hey, you're actually onto something, you're at the very start, but there's something there. That basically defines if you're either pursuing it, or if he hadn't been there, I would have gone with that first person and said, oh, this is a waste of time. I've got no chance of realizing any of this. And I would have probably not pursued it. So, you know, these are inspirational moments, I guess, from the academic side. These two people, John and Lawrence, made a big difference by probably for them not doing much in the first place. Like, he just was positive and encouraging and willing to network me into a new field. And the other person, John, you know, he examined a thesis, which is generous enough, but, you know, really it's for other people defining their careers and pathways. So it's, I'll be forever grateful there.
Quick break here to highlight what I consider to be a fabulous resource that I've created for any listeners out there interested in learning more about the sport for development and peace sector. You've come to the right place. In addition to Inspira podcast episodes that you can listen to, I've created a written resource that you can read, which currently has over 90 items I've curated from my own experience and vetted with other experts in the field. These include databases to find award-winning organizations, links to reports, books, and research, as well as recommended newsletters and recorded webinars, all Sport for Dev related. I encourage you to have a look. You can find this resource by visiting my link tree listed in each episode's show notes, then clicking Erica's Global Resource Hub. That's right, Erica's Global Resource Hub. If you like what you read and what you hear, I'd love it if you could give Inspira a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and write a kind review. That would be so energizing for me. And it would help Inspira reach more ears. Thanks, and back to the show.
3, 2, 1, yeah. Thinking about what happened after that and now to your teaching days, are there certain subjects that you really enjoy focusing on? I mean, I know you mentioned that early emphasis in events and event projects, and I know you've done a lot there as well as in health promotion programs. How would you characterize your favorite topics?
Yeah, I think you've covered it pretty well. So I always, you know, when people ask how to describe yourself, certainly the international aspect is one. So a lot of projects are international, and I think that that adds a different component to, you know, to the work that we're doing. I sit under management. So whilst I've got interest in other spaces, the managerial issues around programs and how to achieve from a management perspective, the design and the structures and the planning of projects to achieve different outcomes is always a big one for me. But then as you said, the event space, the health space, and the peace and reconciliation are probably the main ones. Peace and reconciliation, because I started there and I still think it's got it's a fascinating one where you can see the potential of sport, but, and you know, this is, I'm always big on that. It's the potential of sport. For me, the power of sport is a bit over the top because simply because it would suggest that there is something that's guaranteed to happen, or that there's this magic power to it. It has potential, and perhaps from my management perspective, that's the potential we have to realize or manage to achieve desired outcomes. Because if we don't, you just look around the world, look at a sports stadium, and you see the worst behavior in people. Mm. And so there's no power as such. It really is how we manage things to achieve potential or maximize the potential. And so, yeah, from that perspective, the peace and reconciliation, it has great potential to make a positive contribution. It has massive limits of what can achieve and who it can connect to and with. You know, the extreme sides of the spectrum, you probably won't reach these people, and you just have to realize that's just what it is. And if you've got certain constraints in your, you know, in your budget and in your resources overall, you know, you have to work out where to start, where to make that have the biggest impact, push the boundaries, yes, but yeah, there is probably limitations within the reality that we're working in. The event space I find intriguing as well, probably for similar reasons, because there is potential in using events, but there's also, I guess, a wide rhetoric around the power of events. The events, many of the events are just not sport for development vehicles. They aren't. And if they are not strategically integrated in some of the wider sport for development work, they're great for, they may be good for raising awareness, but that's where it ends. They're not having any sustained change. And perhaps they can't, or they don't have to, because events really, they're designed for a specific purpose. But if we claim that events can have such a big impact, well, then we probably have to do a better job in integrating them with existing programs and having more of a, I guess, sustainable idea or strategic planning from the start of how to really realize and leverage that potential. So that's the event space. And then health is really a new, well, relatively new space for me, where, again, I had the pleasure of being introduced into a new field. Now, health, again, from a management perspective, that's my approach to health. So I'm not someone who's an expert in measurements of glucose levels and, you know, checking how diabetes is impacted by things. But you work with people who are. And so for me, this is actually a good story in a way, because we've talked a lot about inspiration and how perhaps as a scholar, you're working with students. And of course, the traditional way is that your knowledge or your experiences influence some of the thinking of students. But in this case, when I worked in New Zealand for 2 years in 2010 and 11, I was fortunate to work together with a PhD student back then who had experience in working in health and healthy lifestyles in the Pacific Islands. And she developed her practical experiences into a PhD project. And I came on as a supervisor because I had that, I guess, developing countries, low and middle income countries, community development experience. We brought that together with all the health experts that were there. And that student, Katja Ziefken, she's now professor at Hamburg Medical School in Germany. She basically introduced me to a new space and took me over to the Pacific Islands for the first time. And together with a team from AUT, it was where I was able to learn from her in different areas where she was the expert, and I could help her, I guess, with her academic work with my expertise. So it was really a nice opportunity to learn from each other. And that's something I think that's big in this sport for development space, that we've got so many different perspectives and experiences, and bring them together can really work nicely.
And Nico, you mentioned something a moment ago, which I've also heard about, the the doubts of the power of sport. And it sounds like you prefer to say potential of sport, which I'm totally on board with that, even though, you know, I try to use some buzzwords here and there to get people excited. Yeah. But for the sake of speaking to, you know, an expert researcher here, I have heard that there can be an evangelical nature to viewing the sector with potentially the hope of convincing people that sport is good. Like, there were certain moments in time and in the sector's evolution where that was really needed, right? Like, convincing people that there is a potential. So it kind of overtook this wave of, yeah, sport is a cure-all, which we know it's not. And so I'm wondering, you also mentioned there's sports programs and sports events, and they're not inherently going to have a positive impact. Are there ways or like ingredients where you have seen that they can have that potential positive impact? What needs to happen for a sports program or a sports event to have a developmental aspect in your opinion?
Yeah, it's a very good reflection of what's happening. So if we've got ongoing sport for development programs, then the first question is, who is actually in charge of these programs? So if we look, in my case, it's an international focus. If we've got international programs running, so say in your case, the United States or Australia, we decide it's a good idea to support a sport for development program. And Mike, let's use our case here in the Pacific Islands. So our neighbors, and some of the Pacific Islands are quite poor, so low and middle income countries, where we decide it's a good idea to set up a sport for development program that looks at educational outcomes, etc. That's great. Now, that then suggests there's probably funding coming from Australia. There's some oversight of the program needed from the Australian side, but then there is the management of the program, the running of the program, the implementation on the ground, and I guess the choice of what is actually happening, the content. And all of that is at the starting point is an Australian idea of funding something that makes a difference. So what I'm trying to say here is we may have all the right intentions to developing programs to achieve development outcomes, but in the end, we're doing that for people who are not involved in that initial idea or in the initial suggestion of improving things. Now, they may have a very different idea of what needs to be improved, how it's supposed to be run, what needs to be focused on, etc. So I guess step one is to really look at the engagements and partnerships from the organizational or structural setup. And we've talked about a community participation. It's probably more than participation, where really we're working from an initial support from an international setting to making sure from the start that we're achieving a sustained local development without international input in the long run. So that means it's more than just a bit of community consultation about what we do. It's really a strategic plan, and this is the management aspect here again, from the start saying we've got a couple of years of funding. At the end of that funding cycle, we need to have enough capacity building completed for the program, not just the program to be run, but also managed and organized and independently coordinated by the community that it's actually focused on. And so this is my first one that I think is critical. Think about the strategic management of sport for development and the change of power dynamics and independence of programs in the first place. And that would also suggest to me that programs that are internationally funded but only funded for 1 year may never work. There may be good examples or exceptions where that does work. For me, it needs sustained commitment over the longer term to pass on knowledge and build capacity on all levels, including the management. And that's something that probably takes more than a year's funding. Okay, so this is the first place. So the partnerships are critical, the relationships that we have Also, the idea that from a research perspective, for that people want to do a PhD in this space, or they've got a project idea for a particular place, how to prepare best is critical. And even if you've never been to a particular place or country, you can still do a lot of research beforehand before you actually decide that's the most suitable place for my work. Building the connections, building, I guess, networks, going over there, spending time in a particular place. And I don't want to say country, because country is way too big. You really, the time, the place that you want to choose. For spending time as a researcher, it's not easy because no one really has time to do things, but it would be the responsible thing to do. And that's the same for research projects. If we get money to do a project somewhere, spend time researching that place and the ins and outs, and a lot of build a lot of connections to key people that have influence, but also then spend time with the normal people on the ground to get a bit of a sense of what is actually required and if that matches your ideas or not and how that can be brought together. So yeah, listening to people, working together with people and building capacity for people in disadvantaged settings is probably in a nutshell what you want to do.
Yeah, I think a few things I heard you say in some different words are the importance of co-design, like obviously those partnerships, yeah, but creating something with experts, and then that preparation piece. And if you're doing research or whatever you're doing, you mentioned building networks, spending time physically in the location where something will be happening or is happening, and continuing to learn from experts.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess the only thing I want to say there, it's very, very true what you've summed up. It's just the word experts really means, you know, local people are experts. And so if I'm spending time, say, in Samoa, one of the islands over here, and you're going to a sporting carnival that is organized, it's not necessarily the organizer of the carnival that is the expert, but it's the parents that bring the kids there, or the woman that is selling her arts and craft as part of an economic leverage idea at the event, that is an expert, because she will tell you what is probably best for this event to achieve business outcomes. If we are arguing that these sport programs can also achieve benefits for the community, and we're putting an event together and we've got a sports carnival, yeah, that can raise awareness around, you know, the topic that we've chosen, education or HIV or crime resolution or whatever it is. But if we're saying we want to also achieve something like a bit of an economic benefit from it for people in disadvantaged communities, well, speak to the lady who sells arts and craft next to the festival. Is there something we can do better to make sure that her work can be, I don't know, integrated or maximized in terms of selling products to tourists or parents or anyone who's there to visit? So the experts is a great topic. And I don't think we've realized in sport for development that there is many more experts than the ones that have that label officially on their tag.
I'm wondering more about your reflections in terms of the sector, the sport for development and peace sector. What challenges and opportunities do you think exist now that are different than 10 or 20 years ago? Are there any kind of observations or insights you can share?
Yeah, so this brings us back to what you were saying early on, that in 2003, we didn't have the term sport for development. So we raised the awareness, we had sport for development, well, that UN office, we have established then the Journal of Sport for Development, which is now 10 years running, I think.
Yep.
And so there were steps towards establishing sport for development, not only as a term, but as a space that is gaining in legitimacy. Now, things have gone slightly different over the last couple of years, where this United Nations office was disestablished. And I guess that, in a way, is a consequence of our own success, in a way, I think, because sport for development as a space is now, I think, is now recognized. It's I'm going to conferences and I don't have to explain what that term means anymore. People have an understanding of it. We know what we're actually talking about. And so with that gone, there is no other organization that has firmly claimed that representation element on the global level. And that can be tricky, especially where sport for development, if we're honest, isn't as exciting perhaps anymore as it was 20 years ago, where it was new as a term and a space. Now there is other for development ideas that may be the flavor of the month. And so sport for development needs to, and that's from a challenge perspective, needs to almost defend this space that it has built over the years and the support it gets from governments, also from donors, from philanthropists. And so getting resources into this space, a space that has been growing significantly and where there's probably still the same amount of money or pots of money available, if not less, it's tricky because, again, it gets us into the debate of how to make programs sustainable. Well, if it's not enough support in the first place, it's hard to do that. So I guess these are some of the challenges on the macro level that filter down. And we still, I guess, from the academic side, we still have to work out on the academic, on the policy, of course, in collaboration with our practitioners as well, on those levels, how that representation on the global level, what it can look like, what it should look like, and who could potentially fill that void that we've got at the moment without making it too institutional or too strict, because I don't think that would really favour anyone either. So, yeah, still a great space to be in, but certainly a different landscape to what it was 20 years ago.
Now that we know more about our guest's career journey, the rest of our conversation will allow us to have some fun and get to know our guest on a personal level through some rapid-fire questions. We'll then start to wrap up with pointed questions focused on advice and how our listeners can transform interest into action. Enjoy the rest of the conversation.
Nico, do you support a specific Australian footy team?
Not a footy team, okay, but a rugby league team, which is just as foreign for me than footy was when I moved here. Yes, the Cronulla Sharks.
Going back to Germany, do you have a German football club you support? Is that more in your wheelhouse?
That is more in my wheelhouse, and it's the one with the most difficult name. So for all of the international people that see this podcast, Borussia Mönchengladbach. That's just one name of a town and a club.
I'll take your word for it. I'll take your German word for it. Nico, do you have a favorite food?
Favorite food is goulash.
Okay.
Hungarian.
What about a favorite sports memory?
I've got fond memories of the Euro finals in 2004 where I was in the stadium, but Germany lost that one. So I don't think it's my favorite memory. But I think the Sydney 2000 would be, because it kickstarted so much back then, it was at a great time when I started international career, I suppose. That would probably be my favorite ones, yeah.
Mm. Do you have any fun hobbies in Sydney that are not sports related?
Partly sport related, I suppose. Being of German heritage, I'm going to all the Oktoberfests in Australia, and we've got a little German youth group, and we're doing some of the traditional German dancing at that. So that's a hobby that I picked up here in Australia representing my country, and it looks quite funny when you do the slap dancing on stage. So good fun, especially with a beer in hand.
I was going to say, I'm sure there are certain Oktoberfest reenactments that you can't take your little ones to. So we'll just think of the family-friendly ones for this podcast.
Correct.
And if you could go back in time, what do you think you would tell your younger self?
That if you are starting your, not even your career, if you've got an interest in a particular space and it is something that you believe can happen, it probably will happen if you commit time and energy to it. Don't listen to other people who think that may not happen. If you think it can be done, and it can realistically be done, it can be done. Like it's something that, as long as it's not something completely out of the way, it's if you put your energy and commitment to it, you'll realize it. And you don't have to rely on other people or the luck to meet other people to confirm that it is a possibility. You just believe in yourself that you can make it happen.
I love that. Yeah, it's very, very encouraging for folks out there who maybe haven't seen what they want to do be done, but just go for it. Nico, if you have a student or an aspiring professional who really wants to pursue sport for development long term, what types of career or research pathways might you describe to them?
Yeah, okay. So first up, it's necessary to go and test it. So if you get your opportunity to do an internship or some work experience with an organization, then do it. Now, these are, you know, us two, we're two people who love this space and who have enjoyed working in the space, but it's also not an easy space or a straightforward space. It can be an uncomfortable or tricky space to be in. So I would certainly recommend testing the waters and go and volunteer, perhaps combine it with some travel experience to make it a big trip. If you're a student and you've got your, you know, your break between semesters, spend a couple of months overseas and, you know, use half of that time to volunteer and just get an idea of what that looks like in practice. Then, of course, if you decide it is your space and you want to be part of it, then I guess building from that and spending some more time, even at the very grassroots with an organization, an NGO that looks at sport for development. And there's so many nowadays that have a different focus on how they operate. Some have coaches that are coaches for development. Others are, you know, in looking at volunteer management as their main thing, local international volunteers. Others go to the education space, work a lot with schools. I think you can nowadays find spaces that are a bit more targeted than they used to be. The website, sportanddev.org, and you probably provide a link later on to people, for people to explore what's out there and really just spend some time finding out what area of sport for development they're really mainly interested in, and then giving it a go. I would actually say through an internship or through some work experience first, and then move into opportunities after that. Frankly, if there's no work experience, no one will land a job in that space right away. Like I just can't see these days that an NGO would employ someone full time if they don't have work experience that has shown they are confident and willing to operate in international sport for development spaces. It's just too risky to employ someone out of a CV that is nicely presented. So I guess that's a necessity, but also I guess an opportunity to be a bit more targeted than in the past. From a research perspective, there's obviously ways. If you want to get into research these days, you probably have to complete your master's or PhD as a research degree. There's, again, a little more opportunity to speak to people in the specific area that you would like to work in. So in my case, I'm in a sport management program in a business school. There's a lot of sport for development under health programs, at health faculties, kinesiology in the United States. There's leisure, event management, just straight sociology, anthropology, cultural studies, peace studies. And you just bring sport as your context that you want to work in. So I don't think you need to be turned off if it doesn't say sport in the title. It's just sport is what you bring into it. And for many people that are working in say, sociology, if they have a sport interest, then this is something else and new that you bring to the plate. And I think that's something that we still have to realize, that sport can be quite attractive as a space for research for the more mainstream academics that are working in say, straight sociology or cultural studies, for example. So approaching potential supervisors with intent, and that's, you know, bringing me back to what Erica has done many years ago. For us, looking at it from this perspective, we can pretty much see if someone has tailored their request to you as a potential supervisor, or if it's a copy paste and then my name, sometimes in a different font or size, inserted on top. That's not going to fly anymore, right? So, of course, you know, we get, as academics, you get a fair few inquiries about becoming a supervisor for students. That has to be targeted and tailored so that we look at it as a sincere, honest approach that we are likely to follow up. Ways to get into it and research, it's of course, you know, if you want to do your research career, you end up at a university or a research institute looking at this particular space. You go into policy making as well. So there's, you know, with the different, I guess, global institutions, even if it's, you know, the United Nations or the IOC, they've got certain areas where support for development work or diplomacy work is coming into play. Dare I say, even FIFA has a role in corporate social responsibility. And wouldn't it be nice if someone was in there that had a bit more of a rigorous approach and critical approach to how to maximize their potential? So there is, you know, of course, we can move on into positions that are research, policy, practice related. And yeah, so I think do your homework, test the waters, and then be sincere about getting and reaching out and getting into it. And then, yeah, hopefully it'll eventuate.
What is one thing you hope listeners remember from our conversation today?
That there's more experts than the ones that have the label on their tag. And that giving it a go is critical to achieving things at the top. So you have to start somewhere and can develop up. And I think that's for both of us quite relevant. You
Yeah.
know, when I look at the change of careers, the development of careers, you've given, you know, given things a shot when, you know, times are busy. Times are busy for everyone. But giving it a go, encouraging, I guess, supporting initiatives that you believe in is something that you've done for the Journal of Sport for Development. Now you're in a different context. You're overseas. You're giving these podcasts a go that are a new idea, that are a passion project for you, as you said. This is the same in sport for development, where you know, you have to have the courage to do it. And that's something to remember, to give it a go and listen to the experts, but the ones that you think are experts.
Nico, I think what I hear you saying a lot throughout our conversation is the importance of finding synergies, whether that's
Yeah.
as a aspiring researcher, finding a good fit with a mentor or a PhD supervisor, or if you're a practitioner and you're in the field and you're looking for that local community expert, finding the synergy doesn't mean you and that person need to view the world in the exact same way, but that there's some collaboration potential and you can learn from each other or that give and take. And you gave
Yeah.
some great examples of how that's been really meaningful in your path.
What a great academic summary here, isn't it? Wonderful. No, but that's exactly it. You know, you can't put it any better. That's exactly it. You have to have the synergies across in all these different areas to really achieve the best outcomes and to, you know, brings us back to maximizing that potential. Now, that's not just for sport for development programs, but it also for you in research, but also the wider career, even as a practitioner, having the synergies with partners where it actually works and clicks is going to make life so much easier for everyone. So, yeah, great summary. That's exactly it.
How can our audience support you or your work moving forward?
I guess we've got a diverse audience here in a way. So, you've got practitioners, and there's always been the challenge to bring practitioners and academics together. In sport for development, it's probably a space where it's a little bit better. But I guess from the practitioner perspective, to be sincere about collaborations with academics could be a positive way forward. And that at the same time for the academics means that the engagement with practitioners has to be different than the engagement between academics and academics. And I guess there's a bit of learning that still needs to happen of where we find that middle ground. But if we have the sincere intention to work together for new projects from the start, I think we overcome some of the barriers that, you know, academics are somewhere up here and more philosophers than practitioners, and practitioners just not interested in learning and going forward. That's all really not the case, at least not if you've got the academics that I know, or the group of academics that I represent, and the same for the practitioners on the other side as well. So I guess the engagement is critical, and that's a good way moving forward, I think.
And I'll make sure to put your book and some other research articles in the show notes. So if there's any further interest around that, folks can support you in that way, learn from you and collaborate in the future.
But there's also, I guess, the yes, we publish the books, and there's articles and stuff, but it's also not being shy to reach out, because as academics, everyone's excited when people pick up some of their work, and we're always willing to share stuff and engage. When I say we and all, and not everyone, but the ones who are not, they're not the ones you're interested in anyway. So the sincere ones, the dynamic ones, the ones that have engagement sort of as one of their core principles, that they are. So don't be shy to reach out, but do it with intent. And I guess that's a way of supporting academics. And the other side, we as academics as well, going to reach out to practitioners, but with a specific contribution we can make, and not just, oh, we want to research your program and write a journal article. There's nothing in it for practitioners that way. So
That's a good
there's
point.
something else that needs to happen. And the intent, the specific strategic intent, is something that I would encourage on both sides.
Nico, I have one final question for you, which I invite you to answer in your native tongue of German, if you feel so comfortable. And my question is, who or what inspires you?
Es gibt viele Leute und auch Institutionen, die mich über die Jahre inspiriert haben. Als Akademiker oder jetzt als Forscher sind das Leute, die vorangegangen sind und viel gemacht haben für Sport- und Entwicklungsarbeit im Feld, und die es dann geschafft haben, das Ganze akademisch zu begleiten. John Sugden war einer dieser Beispiele, der viel oder die Vision schon hatte, von Anfang an Sport for Development oder Sportentwicklung zu generieren oder akademisch auch zu begleiten. Und die Kombination aus akademischen Arbeiten und Forschungsarbeit im Feld ist etwas, was mich immer inspiriert hat und was ich glaube, was wir auch mit unserer Arbeit unterstützen und dazu beitragen, dass andere jüngere Leute ebenfalls inspiriert werden. Danke. And the beautiful tongue of German, that was basically the people that inspired me were the ones that were able to combine research and practice and had the vision to make things happen that didn't exist. And John Sugden I used as an example. And I guess with our work now, we're trying to do, or I try to do similar things of combining some of the research with practical work to really move the field forward, not just the research space or the practical space, but really trying to bring it together and make a difference overall. So these are my, that's where I took inspiration from, and that's where I hope that we can again, instill some inspiration in our students moving forward.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Inspira podcast with Erica Mueller Chen. I really hope you enjoyed the episode and found it useful. Be sure to check out the show notes for links and resources. Specifically, my link tree is there with tons of awesome information. Feel inspired to take action today? I've got three action steps you can take right now because you know your girl likes calls to action and the number three. So here goes. Number one, follow the podcast on your chosen podcast platform. Number two, share your feedback with me through the listener survey listed on that link tree. And number three, tell just one friend about this podcast so they can give it a listen too. And do I have any overachievers out there? I've got a bonus action step, which is to consider supporting me and making sure this passion project prospers. So, number four, follow the link to buy me a coffee. That would be pretty amazing. Until next time, stay inspired.